Recorded live.
This is the Patriot Dennis Radio Show. Susie, Barbie, and yours truly, Keith, will bring you the show every Thursday from 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. The Patriot's aim and purpose is to save this great nation from the grips of communism and all the other isms that threaten this great nation. And now, the Patriot Dames.
Hello, America. This is Susie of the Patriot Dames, and today is December the 2nd, 2010. It's Thursday. I've been on the air now almost 3 years, and I'm not going to stop. And the guest that we have with us tonight has been on decades more than me, and he's not going to stop either because he's an historian, and all he's trying to do is tell the truth. I've had Mark Weber from the Institute for Historical Review on several times, and I learned something new every time. I had him on. We talked about the Civil War, which is actually the war between the states. So that was a good show. And if you want to hear that, go back to our archives and you can find it. Now, tonight's show will be about Mark's firsthand knowledge of censorship. And we're also going to talk about the decline of America. You can read his articles on these subjects and much more at his website at www.ihr.org. And if you haven't gone there, you just haven't been around. You need to go there. It's one of the must-go-to sites. And also with Reverend Ted Pike, these men are doing nothing but telling the truth. George Orwell said, "In an age of universal deceit, the truth is a revolutionary act." And with that, I want to introduce to you Mark Weber. Sir, how are you tonight?
Very fine. Thank you, Susie, for having me on again. It's great to be with you.
It's always good to be with you. You're an academic and an historian and a down-to-earth good person, and I admire you very much. You're extremely busy, and I thank you that you're taking time out to be on my show again.
Well, thank you. No, it's my pleasure.
All right. Now, before we get into the censorship question, have you written any books?
I'm sorry, have I what, please?
Have you written any books?
Oh, I see. I've written a lot of things. There's one book by me in the Library of Congress catalog, and it's actually a translation of something I wrote in French, and it's been published as a book on the Nuremberg trials. But unfortunately, the material I've written has not been put into book form, and that's something I hope to correct.
I do too, and maybe I can help you with that because I've been trying to learn Kindle. It's a little complicated, but a friend of mine is trying to help me, so maybe we can all get together. I want my book published. You want your book published. So, and there's another one. I can't remember the name of it, but I think perhaps maybe we should start out with electronic books. I really want my book in print. You know how you want to hold your book. You want to be able to physically send it to someone, and that's what I'd like to do.
Right.
Now, okay, you were on Jeff Rentz's show, but when I went to that website, because he's on Liberty, he's on Freedom Fighters, I think it is, I couldn't find that date that you were on the show. I think it was the 18th, November 18th.
Well, I don't remember now. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I think it was November 18th. But I just wanted to tell you I couldn't find it because I wanted to listen to it. Now, let me ask you this. We're going to start with censorship. Who, WHO, who is censoring your site?
Well, what this refers to, and there's an article on our website homepage entitled Progress in Fighting Internet Censorship, an update, and I've got to even update it from what appears there already. But what this deals with is the phenomenon of internet censorship by web filter companies. Many businesses around the country and some government agencies and some libraries and schools have web filter services or software that block access to a lot of websites. Now, this is an understandable thing. It, for example, it blocks pornographic websites in computer systems in schools, for example. Or a lot of businesses want to block websites for online gambling for their so that their employees don't spend their time doing that rather than doing whatever they're supposed to do in a company. I mean, there's a legitimate or understandable reason why companies and agencies and so forth want software to block websites. Now, what we object to and what's a real problem is that this software is also used to block websites like our website and other websites, not because they are really there's a really legitimate reason to do so, but because outside organizations have gotten these companies to include our website and other websites on their list of websites to be blocked. And this is a problem. There's a few companies that provide this service in the United States and many other people that make use of the service, but the result is that when you go to our website from certain companies and you try to plug in IHR.org, you'll get a little notice that says something like, this site is blocked because of hate and racism or discrimination or something like that. Now, if you have any familiarity with our website, you will know and understand that that's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. The website, this is not a site that any reasonable person would say is hateful or discriminates by any stretch of the imagination. Now, this came up several months ago, and we have ever since then been launching a kind of systematic effort to unblock websites and to go to the companies that provide these web filter services. And I've learned a lot during this time. For one thing, there's a major hospital here in Orange County that when patients try to go onto the website or try to use the computers at the hospital, up comes a little notice saying that our website is blocked because of what they say, hate and racism. Now, I talked to the hospital, and I spoke with the general counsel, the chief lawyer for the hospital. It's a major hospital. And I said, this is unfair, it's inaccurate, and it's defamatory. It's a slur, a smear against our website and against the Institute for Historical Review, which is not justified. She looked into it, and she agreed. She said, no, it shouldn't be blocked. And she took a look at it. And then she said, well, this is because we use the service of a company called WebSense, which is a major web filter company stationed in San Diego. And I wrote to the WebSense company, and I said, your company filter program claims that our website supports or promotes hate and racism. And I said, this is untrue, and we want you to change that with your service. I got back a long letter from a lawyer for the company, and he revealed something that's very interesting. He revealed that the reason that they block our website is a reason not given either to the public or to the clients. He said that our website is blocked on the basis of hate and racism because the company had decided, and again, I'll go into this, the company had decided that any site that has what he calls Holocaust revisionism is therefore promoting hate and racism. Now, I wrote back a long letter in which I said, this is completely unjustifiable. First of all, just because somebody holds a skeptical view about some aspect of the Holocaust doesn't mean it's necessarily hateful or racist or anything. People can hold different views about that or about different things, but to call it hate and racism is not only wrong, but it's deceitful, because no twist on the thing, that interpretation, is not told either to the public or to the company which uses their service. Second, I said that the only category of historical dissident views that that this company calls hate or racism is a dissident or a nonconformist or a minority view about the Holocaust. No other chapter of history is regarded as hateful. Now, that's a little like saying that somebody's a racist if he hates and oppresses people of one race but not of another. It's like saying that only white people can be racist and not black. Anybody who would say that, you would say, well, that standard is simply not credible. It's not justifiable and it's wrong. Justice that's applied selectively, which this lawyer for the company admitted, is not justice. It's a form of injustice. And then I said that, the lawyer claimed that the decision to make a website that has any kind of Holocaust revisionist material classified as hateful was made on the basis of input from clients. I said, well, I don't know who your clients are who would say that, but the vast majority of people we talk to, and I think any reasonable person, would not reach that conclusion. And I suspect that you have been influenced, I said, by a small group of people who have their own agenda and their own interest to push and are not really concerned about hate or racism or what's best for your clients.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I haven't received an answer to that, but we're following up on this because I think that the more the public knows about the deceitful standards used by this company and other companies to block access to our website and other websites, the more people know, the more they'll understand just how unfair it is. Another point I made is that even if there are some items on our website that are, well, Holocaust revisionist, doesn't mean that the entire site can be characterized in that way. For example, you might have in the New York Times articles or guest editorials by, say, a Soviet official, Soviet communist official, but nobody would say, therefore, that the New York Times is a communist newspaper for that reason. Or you might have a guest editorial by a Vatican official or by a leading Catholic or Protestant person, and that doesn't mean, therefore, the New York Times is, therefore, a Catholic or a Protestant newspaper. And by the same token, we have on our website articles of a range of different views. We have articles on our website that are anti-revisionist. And just because a book appears in a bookstore that is either pro-Christian or anti-Christian, you don't characterize the entire bookstore as being one way or the other, because it has a lot of different material. Anyway, these are some of the points that show that this form of censorship is really not only unfair, it's deceitful. They don't even reveal the grounds for this censorship to the public or to their own customers. Anyway, we're following up on this because the more people know about it, the better.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's what I try to tell the people in here. I try to get them to follow these hate bills that are going through Congress that are very destructive to our society. Call the senators, call the representatives, because they don't realize that if even 100 of us do that, we are doing the same thing that the 100 or 200 people are doing to you that are united. And they call in complaints on you, and then whoever this company is, I don't know if you want to name it or not, but this company says, oh, we have a couple hundred complaints, we better listen to them. And they do listen to them. And that's what I try to tell the people. And here, a couple hundred people is very strong. If we could get a couple hundred people to call in to the media, the Congress, their governors, their churches about the USS Liberty, we might actually get some attention. So go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, it's less likely that we'll have an impact with our Congress or with our representatives because these people, I think, are already unresponsive to the will of the people on all sorts of issues, including that. But I think it's more likely to have a response from a company if they are if they understand that their customers realize that they're being deceived. These companies require, for their success, they require good business, and they don't want their customers feeling that they're being deceived by the company. They have to provide a service, which is what it says. Now, another point I've made, too, and this is an important one, I think, as well. I said, your company blocks our website on the basis that it promotes so-called racism or discrimination, again, a smear, but you do not block the website of organizations that routinely promote discrimination. And I mean by that websites like the Anti-Defamation League or the Simon Wiesenthal Center or the American Jewish Committee, which staunchly support the State of Israel, which institutionally and routinely carries out policies of discrimination based on ancestry. And they do a lot of other things that are bad as well. But the double standard of companies that provide this web filter service shows, I think, and again, we're going to try to get more evidence of this, that the, what they're doing is acting as tools of organizations like the Anti-Defamation League or the Simon Wiesenthal Center and not acting in the best interest of their own clients or certainly of the public.
Let me ask you a question. You didn't mention colleges. I know colleges use LexisNexis, and they want people to research on it. But when I was going to college, I couldn't find anything. And I knew it existed because I lived through it. So it's extremely one-sided. It's liberal. Do the colleges also block you? Do you have any idea?
Right. Thank you, Susie. I was just going to bring that up. Fortunately, we have found that very, very few schools, libraries, or colleges block our website, or very few of them block our website. And we have found, I mean, we have a number of people who've been helping us get information like this, and we found that some schools and some libraries do block access to our website, but when we notify them about this and bring this to their attention, their response is to unblock it. Because they are responsible, they're not private companies. They're responsible to the public. And if they block our website, that becomes a free speech issue, not just an issue for a private company. I mean, in fact, private companies ought to have the right to block whoever they want for whatever reason. I understand that, even if it's an irrational reason. What they don't have a right to do is block a website like the IHR website on the basis of a claim that's untrue to the public in general, because they're responsible, they have to uphold some standards. Now, a private company can have no standards, or it can have the most arbitrary standards, but their customers and the public should know that that is the case, and that these companies are acting in an unfair and unjustified way.
Yes. Yeah. Now, what was the question I was going to ask you? You actually got in a little hot water with the Institute for Historical Review when you had wrote an article about the Holocaust, which I understood and agreed with, but you were basically saying, don't make that your main issue. Don't dwell on that. And a lot of people attacked you for it. And then you have people that are censoring your website saying that, oh my gosh, he's a Holocaust denier. So, you know, sometimes you are and sometimes you aren't. Don't you find that amazing?
Yes, that is amazing. I mean, the IHR has acted consistently, but some people wish we were one thing, or some people attack us for being the same thing or a different thing. You can't please everybody. That's just not possible. And it's a waste of time to try to answer all the critics that come up. But the IHR has stayed, our policy and our mission has stayed consistent over the years. There are a few people who want the IHR to be the Institute for Holocaust Review and not the Institute for Historical Review. Now, I can understand that if that's their issue, but that has never been the mission and the goal of the IHR, and I don't think it should be for a lot of reasons. But anyway, you're right. Yeah, for some people say, well, Mark Weber has abandoned the revisionism, or the IHR isn't saying the things it used to. And then on the other hand, we're criticized and smeared precisely for doing that very thing that they say we're not doing anymore.
I know. I that's happened to me too. Now let me ask you this: you were interviewed by Iran's foreign broadcast service. Now, what did you say to tick off the Zionists?
Well, we've ticked off the Zionists long before there was any interview with Iran Radio or anybody else. Over the years, I've done interviews with many, many different broadcasters in Europe, in the Middle East, and in other countries. So that's nothing really new. But the Zionist organizations have been unhappy with the IHR since its very beginning, because we try to be very forthright about this. We say forthrightly what a lot of people know to be true, but who are afraid to say it. Susie, I think, that in 1972, Richard Nixon and Reverend Billy Graham had a meeting in the White House, a private meeting in the White House. We know about the meeting because it was recorded. It was secretly recorded. And in that meeting, Billy Graham said to Nixon that he expressed his concern about what he called the stranglehold of the Jewish stranglehold on the American media. And he said to the president, unless this stranglehold is broken, this country is going down the drain. That's what he said in 1972. And President Nixon responded by saying, do you believe that? And Billy Graham said, yes, sir. And Nixon said back, he said, so do I. He said, oh, boy, so do I. I believe it, but I can't say it. Now, if Nixon and Billy Graham, Nixon was the most powerful man in the world, supposedly, at that time, and the Reverend Billy Graham was the most influential religious leader, or certainly Protestant religious leader in the United States at the time. Mm-hmm. These two men agreed about the danger and the problem of this stranglehold on our media, and yet each of them were afraid to say so publicly. If they thought this was such an important issue, who did they imagine would speak about it? Well, anybody who does speak about it gets in trouble in our society. And as I said, even though Richard Nixon was supposedly the most powerful man in the world, he feared a power greater than his own. That is the power of this what I call this Jewish Zionist power, the Israel lobby, whatever you want to call it. He was more afraid of that power, so afraid of that power that he couldn't speak openly about an issue that he felt was this important. Now, that's the IHR on this and on other issues tries to be truthful in a way that I think is essential in our country, in our society, because the American people are very, very badly misled by our media and by our politicians. And that's what we try to do. So from the very beginning, we have enraged Zionist organizations here in the United States and in other countries.
Absolutely. Now, let me read you something that Ted Pike said. He wrote an article called, he calls it the, quote, "Don't Criticize Jews and Muslims," end quote, bill enters Congress. It's H.R. 6216. But here's what he says, and let me know if you agree or disagree. Since Israel's siege of Gaza and recent deadly flotilla attacks, its reputation has plummeted worldwide, including on American college campuses. Not content to respond with debate and internet censorship, Israel's public relations representative, the Anti-Defamation League, has been struggling to do what it does best, make such criticism a hate crime. Do you agree or not?
Well, I know that the Anti-Defamation League, of course, and the Simon Wiesenthal Center, the American Jewish Committee are doing their best to try to discredit, marginalize, and suppress any kind of opposition like that. I'm not sure how much success they're going to have in actually pushing through any legislation to ban this. That's hard to say, and Ted Pike knows much more about the details of that than I do. I just know, though, that around the world, something is very dramatically changing. There's a consensus all over the world that Israel is carrying out policies and has been for many years that are not only inhumane and oppressive, but which are illegal internationally, which are violations of the United Nations Charter and of American law. That's an important thing. And more than that, which are harmful to American interests. This is a very, very important thing that many so-called American patriots who are supportive of Israel do not understand. They have this childish idea that Israel is a friend of the United States. Many of these Americans consider themselves very strong Christians. And yet, Israel systematically carries out policies of oppression against fellow Christians in the Middle East. And these American Christians are unaware of that, or they want to ignore it. But this, the U.S. alliance with Israel isn't merely wrong and unjust. It's harmful and increasingly harmful to American interests. By supporting Israel, America becomes involved in conflicts and wars which are destructive to our people, to hundreds of thousands or millions of people in other places, and we just can't afford. They cost billions and billions and billions of dollars. And unless and until this grip on our political life, on our cultural life, our educational life is broken, America will continue to have this one-sided support for Israel and all of the pain, suffering, death that it comes with it.
I agree. But breaking it, can we use the First Amendment to break it?
Well, I think the first thing is people need to understand the problem. The very first thing, look, the power of propaganda and political control is not absolute. In the old Soviet Union, all media was controlled by the Communist Party. The only political party was the Communist Party. But what happens eventually is when people see a contrast, contradiction between what they're told by their leaders and what they experience in their own life, then they begin more and more to not they increasingly don't believe anything their leaders tell them. And something like that is happening in America. The level of distrust by Americans of our political leaders has never been so great as it is now, and it's growing. People just don't trust our leaders. The Republican Party makes a big mistake if it thinks that the recent election shows the American public think the Republican Party is trustworthy and not the Democrats. People are just unhappy with both parties, and they've been deceived and misled by the leaders of both the parties so systematically and so much that they're just turning from one to the other in the hopes that there'll be some sort of improvement or difference.
Well, what do you think of the Tea Party? Well, not as a party, but as a movement that could improve possibly one of the parties that would make them work for the people.
I have very little hope of that. The most prominent Tea Party, well, the Tea Party movement held a rally in Washington, D.C. a few months ago. Sarah Palin spoke there, Glenn Peck spoke there. And this was an opportunity for them to lay out what they think is important. Well, it came down to really two things. The Tea Party movement claims that it's in favor of less government and a return to the Constitution. Those are the big points that it makes. To me, those are childishly naive. The problems of America are much, much greater than government being large or small. And in fact, I don't know if Tea Party people even really believe that. I don't think they've thought it through, most of them. But I put the blame not so much on the Tea Party followers, but their leaders. Look, if you look around the world, and I've said this in a talk that's on our website, where would Tea Party people rather live? In Canada, which has a national health care plan and a, quote, big government with fairly high taxes, or in Mexico, which has no national health care plan and lower taxes? Well, most Americans would prefer to live in Canada, even most Tea Party people, because what's important in a country isn't its level of government, it's the level of the quality of the people and the quality of the leadership in the country. Canada is a more desirable place to live in than Mexico or Haiti or Somalia, not because the government is big or small, but because it's a society that's the quality and character of its people is better. I mean, when you look around the world, the countries that are the most desirable countries to live in are generally countries with quote, big government. And the countries that are the least desirable countries to live in around the world are characterized by having very limited government. Haiti has very limited government, and it hardly collects taxes at all, and it plays a very minimal role in the life of its people. But it's a screwed up country and not a very nice place to live, even though it's got a great constitution, at least on paper. Britain doesn't even have a written constitution. A constitution doesn't keep a country from being corrupt or crime-ridden or impoverished. It's just a basic law. And how good a society is does not depend on whether the tax level is this level or that level, or whether the constitution is a good constitution or not. It depends on, above all, the character, quality, culture of the people, and of the character and the foresight and the courage of the leadership of the country.
Now, I agree with your last statement, but where I disagree was when I, in your article, and when they go to IHR, they can read it, America in Decline, A Society in Denial. Where I disagree with you is, and with all respect, Mark, is when we're talking about small government and big government. Small government to me is what we had in the 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s. We still had a small government because we weren't quite flooded with institutions like the welfare state, with busing, with affirmative action, with all the things that put in place what the Jewish agenda wanted us to have. Even Quit Now Smoking is a Jewish organization. And when you put those organizations under the government becomes big. So my question to you is, I don't see where it flows when you're talking about small government and big government into what you said about, well, where do you want to live? My idea is when you're talking about small and big government, why don't we get rid of those institutions that are bloating our government?
Okay, I understand,
okay.
Susie, but, okay, which government do you think that America would be a better country if we had no national park system? Do you think
America would be a better country
if we had no, I mean, what government programs should we get rid of the Social Security system? And even if we did, would America be a better country if we didn't? No, I mean, I'm not saying that this or that government program is necessarily a good one. I'm not saying that big government is necessarily better. But that's not the reason we have these problems. The reason we have a big government, even a small government program is bad if it's administered by people who are corrupt and in a society that's corrupt. But because a country has a quote big government doesn't necessarily mean it's bad. The government is going to be about as good or bad in one area as it is in another. But just making government smaller will not make America a better country.
But see, Mike, I still disagree with you, and usually you can win me over. But when I talk about a small government, what I mean is I don't want, for instance, the welfare state. It was very limited in the 50s and the 60s. It applied to women whose husband died in a war and they didn't have their husbands anymore, or people that had severe handicaps, or the elderly. Liberace's mother was on welfare because she was desperate. She didn't have any means of feeding her children. But I don't think it's fair for you to say, well, if you want a small government again, the way that it was, we're going to have to eliminate the parks and we're going to have to eliminate Social Security. No, that existed when we had a small government. What I'm saying is we need to get rid of the welfare system, number one, which is over $10 billion a year, which, you know, I work at a grocery store now. You would not believe how out of control the food stamp and the WIC program is. These are white people. 20% of the business of this store are people that have WIC and that have food stamps. And these food stamps are, they're buying, well, with food stamps, they can buy almost anything but alcohol or cigarettes. But they eat very well. When I look at the food that they eat, I don't eat that well. You may eat that well, but you have to spend a lot of money to eat that well. And the government, our taxpayer money, our money is supporting these people to eat very well. I don't know what for, because they're not working. You know, they're just, they're losing all their inspiration to get out to get a job. I'm talking about those programs that are bloating our government today. And yes, yes, the health care bill, the health care program is bloating our government. So that needs to go. Go ahead.
Okay. Okay, I understand. I appreciate what you're saying. I understand that. But I think that what you're mixing is what society was back in, say, I mean, well, let's go back to some year that you think things were good. Let's say it's 1960. I mean, to pick a year out of the hat. Well, what was different, what was substantially different, wasn't that government was smaller, bigger. Government in 1960 was still much bigger than it was in 1940 or 1930.
Well,
I mean,
yeah.
What level of government is the desirable one? Well, I think whatever year you think, but the big changes that have happened in America are not due to the fact that government has gotten big, although that's an aspect of it. It's the problems are that demographically America has changed and culturally America has changed during that period of time. Look, and also those people who talk about big government seem almost to ignore entirely the huge amount of increase in government spending for the military.
Yes.
This is very, very different than the kind of country that the people who founded the country wanted originally. But look, I bring up the national park system, or I bring up the interstate highway system, only as examples of government programs that aren't authorized by the Constitution. There's no constitutional mandate for them, and yet most people would say, well, they're good. My point is, even those people who say they're against big government think that they want a bigger government than used to exist. They just disagree about how big it ought to be. And my point is, it's not whether the government is at this level or quite at that level that America's having all the problems it's having. And also, when people make those kind of comparisons, they're comparing only here in the United States. They don't ask themselves, well, what's the proper level of government in the society we want? They just know that right now too many people are on welfare. Well, I understand that. That's perfectly understandable. But does that mean we should not have a Social Security system? Social Security system didn't exist before 1930. Should we get rid of that? Where do we go back to? More than that, even those people who talk about the Constitution can't seem to agree just where we should go with the original Constitution. You know, if we return to the original constitutional republic, Sarah Palin wouldn't have anything to say because women had no role whatsoever in America and political life up until the beginning of the 20th century. Throughout the 18th and 19th centuries, women had no role in American public life. Is that what people who say we should return to the Constitution really want? I don't think so, but they don't have a very clear idea. They just know that things are bad, and they want it returned to some place 20 or 30 years back. And my point is, the problems we're having is not because the government has gotten big. California has changed dramatically over the years.
Right.
Detroit has changed. But those changes aren't because government has gotten big. It's because they've changed demographically and culturally over those period of time. And those are issues that most Tea Party people want to ignore. They don't want to acknowledge.
Well, let me ask you this then. When, if we are not to return, if we are not to get, I'm not talking big government being bad. I mean, if big government totally included everything for the safety of the people and did include roads and parks and anything that made our life good and encouraged us to have our own businesses here and start our industries again, then if that was a big government, I would be happy with it. But your issue is censorship. And aren't you sort of returning to the days when censorship didn't include hurting people like you? Yet at the same time, you're saying, well, we have to accept what we have now. We have big government. So, you know, I'm asking you, aren't you like playing both sides?
Well, Susie, where in American history do you think things were approximately where you think they ought to be? I mean, look, there's always existed censorship of one kind or another in American life. I mean, there was up until the 1960s, motion pictures were far more censored than they are today, for example.
Do you know why? Because Senator Joseph McCarthy banned those people from making movies until about 1965. That's why it all exploded. Yes.
Okay. I'm not saying, look, there were many, many restrictions that don't exist today in American life. I mean, up until the 1960s, there were prohibitions about who people could marry based on their ancestry.
Right.
I mean, there were many, many examples like that. In some ways, government played a bigger role. It was more intrusive. It said that women had no role in political life, for example. Now, I'm not arguing that. My main point, though, is that the changes in America are more in character, culture, and demographics. That's more decisive and more important than how big or small the government is. Oh, I'll put it another way. Do you think, then, that the way government operates in Mexico or the way society is organized in Mexico is a desirable model for the United States? Is that where we should be headed?
But Mexico never had the 200-plus years that we had. They never had it.
Well, wait a minute. Mexico has a tradition much more like America than Canada did. Mexico fought for independence from Spain. Canada stayed a British colony, stayed a British dominion. Canada didn't even have a constitution until 1982.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, but you're simply making my point. I mean, each country has to go by its own experiences. But to say that the answer for America is because, well, big government sort of is bad here, but not bad for Mexico, it's kind of silly. I mean, Denmark's had an existence far longer than the United States of America. Britain has been a country with the same flag and more or less the same government for longer than the United States, but it doesn't even have a written constitution, and it has a national health care plan. Does that make Britain a terrible place to live? And does that make Mexico a good place to live? Well, no.
No. But I don't do comparisons like that. Like in Columbus, Ohio, whenever the politicians wanted something, they said we need more money. They would always say, and that's all over the nation, we need to cut police and fire. That's a threat. You know, to me, that's a threat to say, for me to say, I want these bad institutions out of my government, and that includes welfare. But to compare it to Mexico is saying that I have no right to say something about my government?
No, of course. No, Susie, no, I'm not saying that. Look, I think that the leadership of both the Democratic and Republican Party has betrayed the interests of the American people. I'll give one major example. I think the globalization of trade, the North American Free Trade Association, has shown that the leadership of both parties put the capitalist interest of major corporations ahead of the interest of the American people. Both major parties have said that Americans are going to compete with people in China and India in living standard and in wages. Americans are going to have to compete with those people. That, I think, is crazy. That's resulted in the exporting of American manufacturing jobs, and it's going to lead to even greater problems in the years ahead. It shows that they don't put the interests of the people first. But that's true of both of our parties. And much of the Tea Party anger is that they don't really trust our politicians. That's true. But why are our politicians so untrustworthy? It's not because the government's gotten bigger. People just are worried about them having any power because they don't trust them. I understand that. That's understandable. Mm-hmm. But the problem is we have a political system and a political ideology that is fundamentally wrong. And trying to make it work better is not going to solve the problem, I think.
Let me read, and I agree with you because you are fighting so hard to save this nation. Let me read a quote from, I believe it's America in Decline, that you said, and I think it's beautiful. You said, the country's political, cultural, and intellectual leadership, both liberal and conservative, denies social reality and ignores the historical record, and therefore inevitably betrays the interests of the people, leading America down a path that means even greater anxiety and more rapid decline. What's decisive in determining the level of prosperity, stability, and order in any society is not whether it has a well-written constitution or whether its tax rate is at this or that level. What's crucially important in a nation is the character, quality, customs, and culture of its people and the character, courage, and quality of its leaders. Would you like to comment on that?
Yeah. Well, that's right. Yeah. I mean, look, I gave an example of how our leaders ignore social reality. I gave the example of the so-called No Child Left Behind Act. That was an act passed by Congress with support by both Republican and Democratic Party, signed into law by President Bush in 2001. This act is based on the notion that how well children do in school is entirely the result of socialization and environment. If they can just make their environment and their family life or whatever better, if they can feed them better, they're going to do better in school. It completely ignores the biological reality that some people are not as smart as others. You can't get everybody. It's like imagining you can get everybody to be a champion basketball player. You can't do it. It's impossible. It's utopian. It ignores reality. How people are going to do in school or how they're going to do at certain jobs or how they're going to do in sports is to a great degree a matter of who they're born as, what they're gifted with or not. And to imagine that they're going to improve schools in which children of a lower than average IQ are going to do just as well as kids with a higher IQ is crazy. It's madness. And both the Democratic and Republican Party have, not only with this example, but many other examples, policies that contradict, that fly in the face of reality. They ignore this reality. And by the same token, they ignore historical reality. A society, one of the biggest lies told by many of our leaders is that diversity is our strength. It's our greatest strength. So the way to solve the problem is to make America more diverse. Well, this is crazy. Around the world, one of the features of stable and prosperous societies is not diversity, but cohesion and unity. I mean, part of the reason that a country like Denmark or Norway are so prosperous is because they are overwhelmingly homogeneous. They're culturally and ethnically unified. And the idea here in California, there are tremendous differences between the quality of life in South Central LA or Oakland on the one hand, and some of the cities in Orange County, which are at the top of the list of the most safe cities in America. Some of the most unsafe and some of the safest cities are here in the same state of California. Well, why is that? It isn't because the laws are different. It's because the people who live there are different. And our political leaders completely ignore that reality. And any society that tries to push ahead by ignoring reality is going to fail.
Yes. Now, let me ask you this, because California is a mess, is that correct?
Well, California is not only a mess, It has a $25 billion deficit right now, annual deficit. Nobody knows how that's going to be dealt with. But the worst thing is California is the harbinger. It's the foretaste of what's happening in the rest of the country. The trends that happen in California are an indication of the direction of things in the rest of the country. Now, I've dealt with California in the 50s used to have an educational system that was considered one of the best in the country. It had a very good system, or at least people thought, of elementary schools. Today it's down at the bottom, down near Mississippi or something. Well, why is that? Of course, some areas of California are still very desirable. But overall, the quality of life, the quality of education, the quality of the cultural level has declined in California just as it's declined in the rest of the country. And that's a trend that you can see happening here in California, and it's going to be happening, if it hasn't already, in other parts of the United States as well.
Okay. Now, one of the people asked the question, but before I get to that question, I'd like to ask you this. Many people have said to me that they think that we're going to go into a horrible time. It's going to happen soon. People will be denied food. The price of food will go out of sight, and the food stamp program will be cut. Do you think that's true, or do you have an opinion about that?
It's hard to say. You know, the biggest thing, Susie, is, and people haven't quite got this yet, I mean, because people want to ignore it, we just don't have the money anymore. We're like a person who's maxed out his credit card, and we can't make the minimum payments. We have to borrow money from China, from Japan, and other countries just to keep things going. It cannot go on like this. Something's got to crack. Now, people know this on a certain intellectual level, but we've been living on borrowed money for much too long, and our leaders are grossly irresponsible because we expect and have a right to expect that our political leaders are looking ahead to the future, and they don't. They don't. They've been focused on getting reelected. That's their priority, not the long-term interests of our country and our people, and they've shown that by their readiness to lie and deceive the public when it comes to foreign policy and domestic policy. But yeah, there's all sorts of things that could happen. If they run out of money to pay food stamps and pay welfare, there could be huge riots, as there has been in other times in our history in some of the major cities. Heaven knows what would happen. I mean, how do we deal with that? Nobody has an answer. There's all sorts of things that could go wrong, and it's hard to predict just how it can go wrong or in what way or what would break first. But I think, as you quoted, inevitably things are going to decline more because the principles and the outlook upon which we're doing things is fundamentally mistaken and wrong. And it's like the old Soviet Union. The old Soviet Union ultimately couldn't hold together because it was trying to make a society work that was contrary to social and biological and historical reality.
Yes. Now, this is a naive question, and I will admit this, but does the United States have the right to shut our doors, deny our debts, and regroup?
You mean, in effect, to declare bankruptcy and say screw you to the rest of the world?
I guess.
Person declaring bankruptcy. Well,
and that's
yes,
a question.
I mean,
okay.
Well, if the United States was to repudiate its debts overseas, well, what would happen is something. There would be two consequences. One, of course, is that just like as it happens with an individual, people aren't going to lend you any money anymore. They don't trust you. If an individual declares bankruptcy, then it's usually harder for that person to get credit to buy a house or to get a credit card. Now, that's one thing. But the other thing is this. The American economy is still the number one economy in the world. So that's why even foreign countries that are distrustful of America don't want America to fail, because if America fails, it's a disaster for everybody. Look, China, for example, they hold huge amounts of money from the United States. They don't want the United States to go bankrupt because they want to get paid and they want a market for their products. The countries around the world don't want America to fail, but they don't. That's why they were angry. Just the other week, the Federal Reserve said that it was issuing $600 billion in buying treasury either bonds or treasury bills. And in effect, it's pumping $600 billion more into the economy. Now, most of the world thought this was very reckless. It's a dangerous thing because it runs the risk of inflation and of the United States ignored that because we're out of money. America doesn't know else what to do. What we really should do is entirely rethink many aspects of our foreign policy and our domestic policy. We should withdraw this huge military we have overseas that we cannot afford. We have tens of thousands of troops in Korea. We have troops in Japan. We have military bases in Central Asia. Our security does not and should not depend on us having troops all over the world. Nobody thinks that China's security requires it to have troops all over the world or Brazil. And there's no reason why. We should be concerned more about our own country. We have Americans in Afghanistan and Iraq who are building schools and roads in Iraq and Afghanistan when things are falling apart in this country. We're supposedly worried about the border security of the border of Iraq or Afghanistan when we don't secure our own border conscientiously. This is all crazy. And in fact, in order to maintain this, we've got to borrow money from some of the very countries we claim might be potential threats to the United States. This has got to stop. And it will stop. It's going to stop one way or the other. It's going to stop as a very bumpy crash, or it's going to stop because people act conscientiously. And the danger is all of this is going to stop in a way that's very, very jolting and unpleasant for us and for the rest of the world.
Excellent. The two questions I have, I have a number one question and a number two question, but the second question was, what do you think is the solution for the out-of-control spending by both sides? And I think you just answered that. The military is a major issue.
Well, I agree. I mean, certainly, I think that the welfare spending is out of control, what they call transfer payments. And the military is out of control. All that's out of control in our country. It's irresponsible. It's a gross irresponsibility of our political leaders to, in effect, foist a huge debt on a burden on our children. This is just very, very, it's almost criminal. But part of the problem is in our society, politicians who do this are never held accountable. The worst that happens to them is that they lose an election. That's the worst. They still get their pensions. They're still doing fine. Nobody is punished for policies which prove to be very, very wrong. I mean, I could give some other examples. Back 20 years ago, they changed the immigration laws in a way that they promised would not really lead to any big changes. Well, it led to huge changes, but nobody was held accountable for that. Or the war in Iraq was launched by an administration on the basis of claims that were untrue. They were false. They were a deceit. And at the time, you might remember that one person in the government claimed it was going to cost as much as $200 billion. Well, it's cost 5, 6, 7 times that now, and even that was considered a terrible thing to say. Well, the war has turned out very, very differently than they expected, but our leaders aren't held accountable. And it's amazing to me how many Republicans are not enraged at what George W. Bush did. He ran up, for his time, record deficits. I mean, they blame Barack Obama for running up big deficits. Well, okay, that's bad. I agree. But up until Obama, the record in setting deficit spending was by George W. Bush. But too many of our political leaders take the view that if it's our party that does it, it's okay. It's only bad if the other party does it.
Right. Now, let me ask you the first question. The first question was by one of the listeners, what is your opinion of the Obama presidency?
Well, it's both worse and better than I had expected. one of the remarkable things about it is how little things have changed under Obama. He promised to shut down the Guantanamo base. He didn't do that. he more or less made it sound like we were going to get out of Afghanistan. He wasn't a little unclear about that. But we're still doing all of that. I thought at least he was going to make some changes in Middle East policy. But Obama has proven more craven and more subservient to Israel than probably any president in history. And also, even for his own base of support, it's remarkable the extent to which he's turned over billions and billions of dollars to the major banks and big corporations. That's pretty amazing coming from a man who's supposedly a leftist. On the other hand, I guess this is the real tragedy, is both that things haven't – well, both the good news and bad news is it hasn't changed very much or as much as anybody thought. But, however, having said that, people are angry at Obama, I think, because he is he's black, and he reminds Americans every day that this is not the country that it was 30 or 40 or 50 years ago. Now, even if he is a capable guy or however capable, he permanently reminds people that the country has changed in a way. He's attacked more as a symbol, I think, than for what he actually does. I'm not one of these people that think that Barack Obama is planning terrible things as much as he is doing the things that every liberal Democrat has done over the years. Barack Obama would not have been elected president under normal circumstances because he's very liberal, except that people were so unhappy with George W. Bush. Now, but he's proven so ineffectual as a president, he may last only one term. But the idea that if Barack Obama is replaced by Mitt Romney or Sarah Palin, that things are going to get really better, I think is an illusion.
Can you give me about three people that you think right now might run for president in 2012 and might be good presidents?
people have asked me that, Susie, and I say you cannot go by what they say because all the politicians promise good things. And I tell people, I think the thing to look for in a political politician is whether he has integrity, whether he has character. Now, I'm going to name three individuals who I think are basically men of character because they've proven this by sticking to principle even when it was difficult. And they're men I disagree with on several issues, but I think Ron Paul, Pat Buchanan, and Ralph Nader all show that they at least have principle. And that means that they'll try to do what they actually say they believe. But I don't see any politician on the landscape who has shown by his record that he's a person of real principle. And but those three men, although Pat Buchanan isn't running for anything now and neither is Ralph Nader, I think all three of those men have at least shown that they are men of character and of principle. Even though, I want to hasten to add, I don't agree with all three of them on some issues, but I think at least they're honest men.
I agree with you, and that goes with the end of your quote, talking about the leaders having character, courage, and the quality of life. Now, we've gone over just a little bit, and I appreciate your time because we've done a lot in this hour. We've even disagreed a little bit, but again, we've come back to the same point, and that is the main point, that all of us can disagree, but we come back to the same point that we want to save this nation. We want to get the truth out about what's going on in this nation, and that's what IHR.org does. So in closing, Mark, what would you like to tell our listeners and the American people?
I think the first thing right now, because the political situation is so dismal, is to be informed and inform yourself reliably. And I think that your show and others that keep alive the flame and the light of truth in this very difficult time are very important. That's the main thing that I think is possible and should be done at this point. When people realize they're being deceived, when people realize that the political leadership is like this, that's the first step, and then we can go from there. But it's important to, I think, shove aside any childish delusions or not look at things as they really are. It's important to look at things as they really are and not mm-hmm. as we wish they were.
Well, you keep me on the straight and narrow, and I can't wait to meet you in person. I don't think it's going to be this year because I'm up north here and we're coming up upon a winter, so I don't think I'm going to be flying around or anything, certainly not driving. But, Mark, I admire you so much. You do everything with kindness and no hate in your heart, and that's how we're going to fix this.
Thank you very much, Susie. Well, I admire you too, and keep up your good work.
Thank you very much, Mark. You're a good man. And I want to thank the American people for listening to us tonight. We'll be back next Thursday. I'm not positive who the guest will be, but I'm sure it'll be somebody interesting. And I want you to visit Mark's site at ihr.org. So I love you guys. Good night, America. See you next week.
The stars shining on the heart, so we could see the truth. There is love inside, everything is smooth. But for now, we'll be right back.
What we're going to play for you now is a fellow from Texas who witnesses an accident and calls his friend to tell him about it. We can assume that 911's already been called.
Right.
And this fellow's driving along in the vicinity of the accident, and he's going to call a friend and describe to him what he has just seen. Here we go.
Hey, Marty. I'm on my way to Place 768. Kind of got hung up and raining out here. I'm on my way into the Dallas. Gary's probably going to be calling you to find out where I'm at if he can't get a hold of me, I'm sure. So, whoa. And I just got a wreck right in front of me. This guy ran a red light and hit four old ladies in an Impala. Just kind of gussed him and turned him around right in front of me, man. That was close. Oh, now this guy's getting out of his car. He's got a white shirt on and a dire cigarette hanging out of his mouth. He's throwing his hands up there like it was their fault. Oh, hold on. He's going over to the window. She's rolling down the window. Oh, man. I think he's spraying him with pepper spray, man. He's holding his face, and he's beating him with an umbrella. The other woman is in the house, too. There's one woman with a little black purse. She's kind of out here, man. She looks like a sundown 20 horsepower jackhammer. We got another woman that's eating like she's got a cattle prod, man. She's got an umbrella and she's sticking it in his side. There's another one that it's a little woman just like Mother Goose. She beat him. She's got this new big bag. It's huge. She's about 4 foot nothing. She hit him over the head. Everything went all the way. Her Bible fell. She's in the name of the Bible. Oh, this still beats the hell out of this stuff. She picked his Bible up and raised it up above her head and just beamed the guy. This guy's not getting up. They're still hitting the one with the little black person is still all pieces of it. Okay, he's up on the car. The little woman just beamed him again with that big bag. He's running away with his car. He's out of there. I wish you would have been here, man.
Thank you.
This show is brought to you by the Patriot Dames. Please visit Susie and Barbie's website at www.thepatriotdames.net and donate. The Patriot Dames is a copyright name and logo, and any uses of it are prohibited. You are now leaving the Patriot Dames radio show. Have a safe journey until next Thursday at 8 p.m. Good night, America.